I'd like to dedicate this sermon today in memory of Tony Giardello. Many of you know that Tony for a long time was chair of the missions board here at WBC. He just recently came back onto that board this year. What you might not know about Tony is whenever the mission board had a fundraising goal when he was chair of it, whenever there was a goal that it was trying to get to and the amount of funds that were being drawn in, if we didn't reach that goal, Tony would always chip in the rest. So we always made it right on the nose. And it didn't matter how much this cost, how much it took out of his own pocket, he did it. And nobody knew, not even his wife. This is just the type of guy Tony was. The Book of Daniel is a book about mission. It's a book about what it means to be the people of God in the midst of a world that doesn't know God. How do we be the people of God in a world that's running on its own steam? How do we be the people of God in a world that's going its own way, that turns out sometimes to be lost, maybe confused, maybe even antagonistic? How do we be that kind of people? This is what the Book of Daniel is about. We learn at the very beginning of the book, in chapter 1, when it says, "In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it." We learn this bit right here in this word, Babylon. Babylon. Location, you see, is extremely important in the Bible. From the beginning, the land of Babylon is seen as this place of the anti-God. The anti-God. The name itself is a variation of what we find in Genesis 11 with the story of the Tower of Babel. In this story, in the Tower of Babel, God's project to bring all of humanity back into a healthy relationship with him is jeopardized. It's jeopardized thanks to this collective human decision to build a tower all the way up to God. This is a story about an all too common attempt to get to God on our own power. And what happens is we become divided. We become confused. Instead of one people, we become many. But God is not without his own resources, come to find out. In the very next chapter, in Genesis chapter 12, he calls Abram out of the east, out of what would have been Babylon. And he tells Abram to go to a land he doesn't know, to an alien country. So that, he says, all the nations of the world may be blessed. This is God's plan, to go out into alien country so that they can be blessed. Abraham and the Israelites would bless and heal the entire world by being witnesses to God's love and God's wisdom right in the midst of foreign territory. You see, the story of the Bible from Genesis 12 on out is the story of how God intends to use the Israelites to bless and heal the whole world. The whole world. I'll give you one example. Genesis 37, we learn about a boy named Joseph. Joseph gets sold into slavery in Egypt. Here, again, we have somebody carried off to foreign lands, and yet Joseph rises to these extremely high heights. He becomes second only to Pharaoh himself, largely because, the story goes, Joseph has this power to interpret dreams, and he has this wisdom to act upon them. The turning point of the Joseph story is when he convinces Pharaoh to plan ahead for this great 7-year famine that's coming. And he says, build these big barns and keep in all this stuff for 7 years because that famine's going to ravage the countryside. And what happens? What happens is this descendant of Abraham becomes the healer of all the nations, the one who literally feeds the world as people from all around Egypt come in to receive food. Ever since the book of Daniel was written, it's been seen as something like a reincarnated Joseph story. Here, Daniel and his pals are carted off to Babylon, right in the very heart of a nation that doesn't know God, like Egypt. And there they rise to great power, thanks in large part to the same reasons Joseph did, to their wisdom and ability to interpret dreams. Daniel is a reflection on the Joseph story. But just as with Joseph in Egypt, the lure of the foreign land is always there, and it's always tempting. This is what it means, first and foremost, to be in exile. This is what it means. We are stuck in a place that is constantly claiming its own divinity. We're stuck in a place that's constantly claiming that it has a better way. Listen to the next verse in Daniel 1. In the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as some of the vessels in the house of God, which were told Nebuchadnezzar brought to the land of Shinar and placed in the treasury of his gods. Why do you suppose we're told this? What's with this little line about robbing the Jerusalem temple? I'm sure the Babylonians stole a whole bunch of other stuff, but that doesn't get mentioned. Instead, we just get these vessels from the temple that are taken and placed in another temple. So what's the deal? The key is where they go. They're taken into Nebuchadnezzar's temple. They're taken to serve and worship with Nebuchadnezzar's gods. In other words, what we're being told here in this little nugget is that there's a whole other battle going on here in the book of Daniel. When Babylon conquered Judah and Jerusalem, it wasn't just a matter of one nation going to war against another. This, we're told, is God against God. It takes the form of temptation, accommodation. When they're carted off, when Daniel and his friends are carted off into Babylon, they're going to face a whole other world that's going to be vying for their souls. By the end of the 1800s, the French had conquered much of Western and Central Africa. This is the colonial period, all right? A part of their general strategy for colonization was that they would often bring some of the folks who they conquered, some of the folks they now ruled in Africa, back to France. They'd bring them back where they would be enculturated into the ways of modern France. They'd become Francophones. This was considered enlightened colonialism. You make them French and you've got yourself a docile and willing subject. There may have been a sense of benevolence here, but in the end, this was a stratagem for conquering. It was a system for control. We see the same thing in Daniel. Then the king, we keep reading, the king commanded his palace master Ashpenaz to bring some of the Israelites of the royal family and of the nobility, young men without physical defect and handsome, versed in every branch of wisdom, endowed with knowledge and insight, competent to serve in the king's palace. And they were to be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. This is textbook assimilation. When I was in Dayton, I did some work in the American school system, on the American school system, especially in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And what I found was this orchestrated push to what the literature called Americanize them. You were to Americanize these huge numbers of immigrants that had been coming over from Central and Eastern Europe. Many of these folks were Catholic. And the big push at the time was to get rid of all these parish or parochial schools because they were thoroughly ethnic. The thinking was that if we require them to go to public schools, then they'd be forced to learn English. They'd have to read some Shakespeare. They'd become true Americans, and we wouldn't have to worry about them defecting or, worse, changing us. Ironically, a lot of the push here came from Catholics themselves who saw this Americanization as a way to prove their American credentials. Stop teaching your kids German or Lithuanian or Italian and instead teach them English. Otherwise, all this anti-Catholicism that we're facing is never going to end. This was the logic. Of course, the pushback was this, that if they did this, then they'd lose their identity. They'd stop being Italian. They stopped being Lithuanian, or they stopped being German, and they didn't want to be Anglo. They didn't. That wasn't them. They wanted to be Germans and Italians and Lithuanians who just happened to live in America. This was their culture. That's who they were. They wanted to keep it that way. It's the same thing going on in the book of Daniel with him and his friends when they find themselves in Babylon. They're Jews, but they're now learning the king's language. They're reading the king's books. They're eating the king's food. Their identity as Jews is at stake. Subtly, and yet surely, they're being assimilated into Babylonian culture. How long? How long until they go the whole nine yards and take on the Babylonian gods? This is everything that's going on right here. All of it comes to a head in verse 7 when Nebuchadnezzar decides to give them what? New names. Babylonian, Chaldean names. Daniel becomes Belshazzar. Hananiah, Shadrach. Mishael becomes Meshach. And Azariah, Abednego. The Bible pays a lot of attention to names. It thinks they're important. In Genesis, Abram becomes Abraham because he's going to be the father of many. Jacob becomes Israel because he wrestles with this angel of God and wins. In both cases, the person's name is changed because their fundamental identity changes. This is what is happening with Daniel and his friends. The question is, will they accept it? Will they accept this new identity? Will they assimilate and become Babylonians through and through? This is the question. This is the problem of exile. Is this how we go? So this is the sort of struggle that defines us when we talk about being in exile. In Romans 12, the Apostle Paul urges us not to be conformed to the ways of this world, but to be transformed, he says, by the renewal of our minds, so that we might learn what the will of God is, the good, perfect, and pleasing will. You see, the not-so-subtle subtext of Daniel is that we are residents in a foreign land that's not only alien, it's seductive, it's enticing. And our task isn't just to stay the course, it's to show just how much better and more beautiful this God way is that we claim. And this is, lo and behold, precisely what Daniel and his three friends do. Look at verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine, so he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. And the palace master said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed your food and your drink. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your age, you would endanger my head. This guy is rightfully worried, but Daniel is insistent. Please test your servant for just 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then you can compare our appearances with the others. It's often assumed that the issue here is one of keeping kosher, we talk about. But it's not just kosher. For that matter, wine wasn't an issue of kosher. And yet, Daniel says, don't give us any of that. You see, what's at stake here is the same thing that was at stake earlier when we heard talk about learning the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The people who sat and ate at the king's table were part of his entourage. To use an old English word, they were part of his thrall. Y'all heard that word before? If you watched Game of Thrones? Probably, okay. I actually haven't, so that may not be in Game of Thrones. No, drat. It would fit. I'm disappointed. All right. Should not have gone on that tangent. All right. If you're sitting at the table of the king, eating the king's food, you're sitting next to his kids. You're sitting next to his kids. Daniel and his friends decided that was too much. Too much. They'll serve the king, they said, but they won't be his children. They won't become his flesh and blood. There's this certain distance they have to maintain, otherwise the very identity is at stake. In one of his books, Malcolm Gladwell, I'm a Malcolm Gladwell fan. You may not like Malcolm Gladwell. I like Malcolm Gladwell. Gladwell tells a story of a town in Le Chambon, France. And he tells the story of its Protestant Huguenot pastor, a guy named André Trocmé. For centuries, Le Chambon had been a haven for dissident Protestants. like the Huguenots, who are trying to carve out a living in the high mountains of Catholic France. On the Sunday after France's fall to the Germans, though, in 1940, Trockney preached this sermon. He said, "Loving, forgiving, doing good to our adversaries, this is our duty. Yet we must do this without giving up, without being cowardly. We shall resist whenever our adversaries demand of us obedience contrary to the orders of the gospel. We shall do so without fear, but also without pride and without hate." You see, there will always be levels of accommodation and enculturation in the midst of exile. We're never told, after all, that Daniel and his friends refused to read and write in Babylonian or Chaldean. This is why I've titled the sermon "Resident Aliens." We're both resident and alien at the same time. We're both of this world and yet not of it. Occasionally, though, there are times when the two worlds collide, the resident and the alien, and where we find that the very nerve of the gospel is exposed and at risk of being severed. The very nerve of the gospel is exposed and at risk of being severed. It's at times like this that the book of Daniel is telling us we have to stay the course. We have to resist the king's food. But there's a seed of hope here. The seed of hope is that in this resistance is the substance and the fruit of mission, of our mission to the world. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel tells us the four of them appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to hold back their food, the royal rations and the wine they were to drink, and just to give them vegetables. And among them all, no one was found to compare with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Our own history is full of stories like this, when the gospel proves itself a bit more beautiful than the world in which it lives. I remember the story, one of those stories, of Martin Luther King giving a speech in Birmingham, Alabama, when a large 200-pound white man charged the stage and started just pummeling King with his fists. King responded not by hitting him back, but by hugging him. And when King's friends came over to try to separate the two to protect King, King instead turned and pushed them away to protect the 200-pound white guy. After things had settled down a bit, King brings the guy to the front of the stage, and he introduces him to the crowd, not to heckle him, but as a place of honor. His name was Roy James. He was 24 years old. He lived in an American Nazi dormitory around Washington. And he was standing up there with King's arm around him. And he was, as he stood there, he began to weep. He just wept. He was overcome by the love of the gospel, by what King was showing him. You see, the story of Daniel is the story of mission. It's the story of how the beauty of the gospel can shine in these remarkable ways, even if not especially in the midst of these contrary ways of being and behaving in the world. This past Wednesday, I got the chance to hear Brian Stevenson give a talk at the Aronoff. Stevenson is an attorney and a human rights lawyer who does a lot of work on death row. One of the key things he noted on Wednesday was that we live in a culture driven by fear and anger. And the church is tasked with changing the narrative of fear and anger to the narrative of hope. But what stuck with me as I was walking back to my car on Wednesday night was this. Stevenson said that we cannot work for justice and mercy. We cannot work for justice and mercy without being in proximity to those who need it. We can't work for justice and mercy without being close to those who need it. We cannot even really understand what justice and mercy are if we aren't on the ground running with these folks, if we aren't in their midst. He put it this way: good people must position themselves in difficult places so that they can be witnesses to the hope and the life that true justice and mercy bring. We're that good people. That's what we claim. This is what we see in Daniel. This is the call upon us. Even though exile could be seen as this victory of godlessness over godliness, Daniel tells us that God can use our status as resident aliens in the world to heal it, to bring it life, like a seed that sprouts only when touched by fire. There are those. I looked it up. The question is, and this is the question Brian Stevenson left us with, it's, are we willing to risk those difficult places? Are we willing to risk it? It was an irony because we were all sitting there in the Aronoff, which is quite nice. And he told us, he called us, he encouraged us, he laid it on us to go visit the lynching museum down in Alabama, to be in the space, in proximity with our own history, so that we can really know it. So that we can know it. He was saying, if you are not putting yourself in the very places where you can witness to the hope and life that true justice and mercy bring, then you are not doing mission. This is what Daniel says to us. If we're not putting ourselves in these places and among these people, then we are not doing the mission of God. We're not in the mission of God. We're not healing. We're not giving life to the world. If we just stay in the Aronoff, if we just walk back to our cars, then what are we doing? That's the call of Daniel.